Dave Smith sees writing as an act of recovery. When he was in high school in the Virginia Tidewater region, his father died in a car crash, and looking back, there were blank spots in his memory.
What I discovered over the years was that, oddly enough, with poetry, I could dig my way back to re-experiencing moments by combining a process of inventing and remembering. I was able to create a reenactment. So recovery is a process that's central to my sense of what a poem tries to do.
Discover how this also applies to Dave Smith's essays as he reads from his books Hunting Men, Reflections on a Life in American Poetry, and The Wick of Memory, New and Selected Poems, today on New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam. Honored for his 50 years of writing at the 2017 AWP Conference, that's the Association of Writers and Writing Programs, Dave Smith is a poet of place who also recognizes the influence of other writers on his poetry, fiction, essays, and memoir, beginning with The Shadow Cast by Edgar Allan Poe, a student the century before him at the University of Virginia. Smith went on for advanced degrees at Southern Illinois and Ohio Universities and has taught around the country, but returns often in his work to the Virginia Tidewater of his youth. He discussed that in the first half of this conversation, recorded while at Rockhurst University's 2014 Midwest Poet Series, where he read several elegiac poems. Dave Smith picks up on the importance of that form.
When I talk with my students about elegy, it's important for me to mention that we've come so far. We almost tend to define elegy simply as a poem of praise. But I like to go back to Milton, to Lycidas, a poem Samuel Johnson disliked immensely. I like it immensely. Lycidas was a pastoral and funereal elegy. The elegy had as its structural foundation the need to ask questions. In Milton's case, his friend, whom he called Lycidas, Edward King, had died aboard a boat passing between England and Ireland. King had been a fellow student at Cambridge, and he had become a minister. In Milton's perspective, to be a poet, a minister, and a Cambridge fellow student was to be really the greatest, the most hallowed. How could God let this happen? That was the question. And the elegy was structured to ask such a question.
I love that, going back to Milton and what that meant. Do you think that you're drawn towards elegiac poems? I mean, not all your poems are like that, but...
Most are. That's a fair characterization, and I think there's an answer for it. I think the poetry of the 20th century, if not indeed the 19th century, is dominantly elegiac, particularly as a poem moves away from the traditional forms of dramatic and narrative strategy and moves toward a lyric endeavor. I think elegy, which is a form of praise, becomes more and more prominent. So I think, for me, elegies still put us in the position of trying to explore the mysterious and slippery grounds on which all of our lives, one way or another, rest. It seems to me that it's perfectly legitimate that as the 20th century drifts farther and farther away from the old institutional answers to our questions, that it drifts toward an art form that can ask and at least try to know what questions have answers, if any.
That also goes along with the idea of recovering and uncovering in your essays.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Angela Elam with Dave Smith, who has written almost a couple of dozen books, primarily poetry, but you've also written lots of essays, including Hunting Men, Reflections on a Life in American Poetry, which came out in 2006. I think I'm going to have you read just a short paragraph at the end of what opens up Hunting Men, because I think it shows in your introduction, and I have to say the introduction goes on for a while, so people will know that they're only getting a little bit of the end, but there's something about this that sets up what it is that comes to us throughout the book. So would you like to read this last paragraph?
Sure, happy to. I'd like to say in advance that I tell a little story that involves my dear and old friend Lee Smith, the North Carolina novelist. You'll never encounter a more genial, gracious spirit than Lee Smith. And she sent me the newspaper article that shows up here. Not long ago, I had a letter from a novelist in North Carolina, which included a news report about dwarf tossing, a sporting event unknown to me. I knew anything was possible in the South, but suspected that I was having my leg pulled. Then my local news reported dwarf tossing had been outlawed in Florida. Soon, a follow-up article said a number of dwarves were protesting the new law on the grounds it discriminated against them and prevented them from working. No information was offered as to whether wins were based on distance, weight tossed, or stylistic skill, the sort of details that matter to writers. To those interested in how one could tell that story, how language presents, makes, and interprets both what happens and what we imagine, poets think that way, which is why Delmar Schwartz wrote that in dreams begin responsibilities. Poets are dream hunters. The dreams of my region, if psychotherapy has taught us anything, are universal, but the costumes and dialect are site-specific. The good poem tells a single story of life and death, renewable and enacted. It is a special, privileged form of communication with an infinite capacity for formal innovation. Even dwarf tossing has a plan, an idea of quality based on a prior and tempered judgment. Good readers, like good poets, rise to the poem's occasion. They trust instinct. They prepare. They adapt. They apply a kitchen sink of knowledge. Reading poems is, for me, like good days with hunting men who make interesting a life often unbearably grim, who know where the secrets might be. A poem knows, too. I have tried to be faithful in this book to that experience of poetry in what follows. My success, if it occurs, will be to send readers to the books of the poets where the world as they knew it waits and is full of the delights of the unglimpsed and known.
That really does set the tone for what's ahead in your collection of essays, Hunting Men, Reflections on a Life in American Poetry. This is New Letters on the Air. You weave that outward ritualistic world of hunting and the outdoors in with creating poetry. That comes up again and again in your essays. And I also love, too, how your essays have unexpected moments in them where you're trying to suss out your own being in the world as, say, a Southern writer, or where you fit in with the history of poetry and where others fit in, too.
I'm very pleased that you found the book rewarding, because I still wonder why anybody would care about my life. It's just other than me. In a curious way, all the poems I think I've ever written have been ultimately autobiographical. They have tried to investigate, to explore, to know something about the life I've been privileged to have. And the essays in this book have tried to follow that same direction. Many of them are, to one degree or another, autobiographical. A number of the poets that I wrote about have been friends or people who I encountered in one way or another. I don't know that I would call Mr. Poe my friend, and yet when I walked past his room at the University of Virginia mornings on my way to class. He came to feel a real presence to me and has remained a presence all my life.
Well, you know, you actually say in this book, in one of the essays, you're talking about the role of the poet and that the poet will take an anecdote in a direction that allows illumination. Mm-hmm. And I think that you do that in your essays as well, you know, telling something that has affected you, but it illuminates the human experience too. And I...
What could be better?
What could be better? So. That's what we as readers want when we go to a book, I think, is something that will make us have a different perspective, that will illuminate those dark corners.
There's a little anecdote I like to tell. It's illustrative of this mystery. And the mystery I'm talking about is, let's say, the difference between representation, a kind of realism, and representation, a kind of mythologizing. I have a poem that I wrote about a time when the Chesapeake Bay froze over. I saw a photograph of the Chesapeake Bay. This would have been the early part of the 20th century. And I saw this photograph. There were people standing way out on the ice. There was a Model A Ford on the ice. I took this to be an astonishing thing because I grew up knowing that salt water, which is what the Chesapeake Bay is, doesn't freeze. Or if it freezes, it takes the kind of intense and prolonged temperatures that we didn't get. But I didn't really know. Now I do. The Northern Bay up around Maryland tends to be much less salty because of the flow of the Potomac River and the Susquehanna and so forth.
So the brackishness is less salty.
It could have happened. Yeah. You know. Yeah. So anyway, so I wrote this poem, and I remember reading it somewhere. And as often happens, people very kindly come up to you after the reading to tell you little anecdotes of their own. And a gentleman said to me, "That couldn't have happened." Older gentleman said, "That couldn't have happened." I said, "Yes, sir, I know what you mean." He said, "Saltwater doesn't freeze." I said, "Well, I believe I saw the photograph." He said, "No, you're mistaken." And you come to realize maybe you were mistaken. Maybe you invented it. Maybe this was entirely a fabrication. He walked away, and the woman behind him, elderly white-haired lady, said, "Well, that was the winter of 1916. And, you know, I never went to check it out. I didn't care. What I cared about was that both of them heard something that was so true to their own sensibilities that they could approach it as a fact, not as a fiction, an artifice. But in fact, I don't care. Memory is sometimes writer, and invention is sometimes writer. I'm happy to inhabit the land in between as much as I can.
And, well, how about we hear that poem?
It had a long title. It was a poem called Photographic Plate, Partly Spidered, Hampton Roads, Virginia, with Model T Ford mid-channel. If I were going to be a realistic critic, I would point out to the writer of this poem, at the time it was taken, we were past daguerreotypes, which would have been a photographic plate. So it probably wouldn't have been spidered, although I liked it that way. And it probably wouldn't have happened in Hampton Roads, Virginia, where the water would have been much saltier, being not more than 30 miles or so from the Atlantic Ocean. But you put things aside when you're trying to have an effect. We're all imitating other poets. Poetry, as Wordsworth said, is made of poetry. But in this particular case, I think I had in mind back behind me Auden's Musée des Beaux-Arts, where he's reading a Bruegel painting. And so in this case, I'm reading a photograph. But the difference is Auden's readers would have known the painting and could bring their own expectations to it. I have to provide enough details and narrative to cause you to care one way or another. No one alive has seen such ice, but the 5-mile floor of water so clenched itself, salt broke down. Among us, even the age-wearied would not dream you might walk the Chesapeake Bay and look unafraid on its lucid darkness. And the fathers of fathers, boatwrights, sailors of all waters, never guessed this stuttering machine might take them so far. That's a reference to the Model A Ford. But someone, joking maybe, rolled that small house on perilous wheels down the banks of the James, gunned it forward for skids, runs, circles, a day of such joyous noise the dead seemed to have risen. So many, great-booted and black-coated, are out there. We cannot tell what they think, who find themselves dancing on the road where no road ever was, out there with the long skirts, a few thick-waisted grandmothers, even a scatter of children, cast about. All of them face east to Norfolk, where ships doze, like the unimaginable beasts the sea has given to men's dreams. The Model T is small, black, plain, and appears cornered, like something risen through ice. Hands reach in the hazed air, but do not touch what must be chugging in a kind of terror. The plate is dotted far and near. Seagulls, stains, some mistake of glass. Why do their faces look down as if averted? Among these is the one who will breed us. Having crossed a whiteness he will not speak about even to her, whose skirts he will shake us from. But now gears spin inside him, wheels, a future of machines. One day he will tell my father he walked on water, sick, chugging for breath, shunned as crazy, who I remember by the habitual odor of gasoline. When he died, my father said he was too frightened to live. Under the ice where they walk, the dark is enormous. All day I watch the backs turned away for the one face that is mine, that is going to wheel at me the secrets of many.
That's Dave Smith reading a poem that's included in his new and selected poems called The Wick of Memory. And that poem came originally from In the House of the Judge, his 1983 collection. It's called Photographic Plate, Partly Spidered, Hampton Roads, Virginia, with Model T Ford Mid-Channel. That's got to be the longest title.
That's a long one.
I remember you also did that with another poem that you wrote about a photograph that you had seen that had to do with race relations. And then later you did go back and track down that photograph, and it didn't look... The photograph wasn't as you remembered it.
It's absolutely accurate. That's a poem called Pink and Black,
Colors
of Our
Black,
Age.
Pink and Black, that was it, yes.
And, you know, it's funny. I wrote that poem absolutely convinced that I was simply recording a history I had been part of. I'd been a high school student in 1959 in Churchland High School in Churchland, Virginia, which is now part of Portsmouth, Virginia. But Churchland was a segregated school. Schools in Portsmouth were also segregated, but much closer to integration than ours were. And there was a little shopping center in Portsmouth. This is only 2, 3, 4 miles away, called Mid-City Shopping Center. And there had been what I remembered as a riot in town. And so I described the scene in what seemed to me really accurate detail. And the poem was about to appear in the New Yorker. The New Yorker has a fact-checking office, and they called me and said, would you like to look at the photographs, which I knew had been published in Life magazine, but I hadn't found them. So I said, sure, I'll go and look at it. Well, the photographs showed that what had actually happened was the African-American students from Norcom High School, segregated school, directly across from the shopping center, had conducted a sit-in with some of the businesses in that little shopping center. And there had been some verbal belligerence, but very little, and almost none, including the big riot that I invented, was in my poem. I was so disappointed in a way, because it felt to me like, well, you know, anybody knows that, they're just going to think this is a lot of foolishness. And then I wondered, why didn't I know that? Because I went to the kind of high school that you couldn't get out of school without a hall pass. So I wouldn't have been allowed to go to the riot. How could I have been there? if I had thought that at the time, if I hadn't been so out of control with enthusiasm, I wouldn't have written the poem. But again, there's a way in which the poem is truer than the photographs that were in Life magazine or the newspaper reports at the time.
Yeah. I dare say you were capturing the tenor of the times, you know, with the kinds of things that were going on.
Well, I hope that's so. It's very kind of you to say.
So did they publish it as is in The New Yorker? Or did you make any changes?
They did. Okay. They could sometimes be very insistent on changes. But in that particular case, I guess I didn't betray the actual facts in such a glib way that they would have objected, because it did appear. And I can remember thinking, what in the world are people going to say about this?
Did you get any feedback?
I didn't. From a few poets, but mostly I didn't. People who read The New Yorker don't tend to write letters to you unless you're writing a scurrilous article or something.
Right, exactly. So. Well, you know what? I'm going to have you end on just the very first part of your essay that was published in New Letters magazine. It's called When Bird Dogs Roam the Earth, Poetry Hunting the Environment.
I was asked to do a lecture at Washington College in Maryland on the subject of poetry, the environment, and hunting. It's enormous territory.
Huge.
There's no possibility I could do this. And I called the gentleman who asked me to do it. I said, I can't do it. He said, oh, just give it a try. So I was off. And that's the background of this. What I have to say on the subject of poetry and hunting dogs, even more on the environment, is, I admit, less fact than fable. A fable, says the new Princeton Encyclopedia of Poetry and Poetics, is a narrative whose characters may be animals. A narrative, it says, that may be preceded, followed, or interrupted by a separate, relatively abstract statement of the fable's theme or thesis. Yes, all of that. In 2012, the Nature Channel broadcast astonishing film of a giant squid lured to an artificial bait in the Sea of Japan. Only dead specimens of that squid had ever been seen. Some scientists believed them extinct. But there, in live color, was a 30-foot-long monster that leaves scars on the foreheads of our world's biggest animal, the humpbacked whale. Perhaps such a squid is, in whatever nightmares whales have, their Moby Dick. That video reminded me of another discovery. An anthropological dig at Snowmass, Colorado, in 2011, uncovered animal skeletons 45,000 years old, some unusually well-preserved, including mastodons, a camel-like beast, a lion that stood taller than a horse. The strangeness of life can burst through on us in just such ways. Among poetry's most elemental functions is the imagination's measurement of the contradictory, the strange but true. True not only in the exterior world, but also in the inner world of dreams and convictions, where all human action starts. How can we measure those ancient beasts, except against living creatures and ourselves? Think of rib bones longer than fishing rods, skulls the size of SUVs, claws like ski boat anchors. Those super animals were superior athletes and predators. Yet they shrank to today's tinier relatives, and more important, they died out. Man, a better monster, killed them directly by hunting, or indirectly by competition for space and food. We killed them so well, we could almost say we forgot they existed, except as weird bones and broken hints in museums. But that would be wrong. We always have known, as dreams and poems tell us, that all sorts of creatures, strange and not so much, have shared our world. All animals live by awareness, a kind of long-term memory working to protect them. A poem, too, begins as awareness and goes looking for a quarry. We are all predators and quarry, and our wariness means life or death in every moment we breathe. Dogs are wariness experts. They bark to raise alerts. We adore them, except for the neighbor's dog who won't turn off. Man's best friend, we say, though I have doubts about pit bulls and pocketbook dogs. Still, human babies have been nursed by dogs. Twins Romulus and Remus, orphans of Rome, were raised by a female wolf. We keep dogs to be protectors and companions. In films and television, dogs have been leading actors, Rin Tin Tins and Lassies, for whom, who after week shielded little Timmy from evil. A tale so sentimental, fiction writer T. Corrison Boyle's parody portrayed Lassie leaving Timmy for a sexy wolf. We spend a lot of money on images of dogs. Just this past month appeared the New Yorker Book of Dogs, a coffee table collection of poems, stories, and cartoons about dogs. It's really about us, who we are, and, well, who they are. Interestingly, in that book, there are no bad, mad, predatory, or monster dogs, not even regulation wolves. Too strange, perhaps. Just perfect buddies. In the snowmass dig, they found skeletons of wolves 8 feet tall at the shoulder, 600 pounds of fur and fleas, teeth like rail spikes, and bodies perfect to track, run down, and feast on anything alive. Is that so strange to us? Television's hottest recent show, Twilight, portrays giant wolves disguised as sexy teenage boy hunks in dust-ups with equally sexy boy vampires. These wolves shift from human to dog or dog to human at a finger snap. Perhaps Colorado's wolves remain, in our imagination, as normal as we are, and perhaps they call to us through the TV boys. I am certain the language of imagination has access to a knowledge we can't articulate otherwise. This language rises in nightmares, myths, fictions, and poems, all attempts to measure human identities within relationships to animals. My particular relationship in what follows is to a bird dog.
That's the start of the essay from the 80th anniversary edition of New Letters magazine, published the year before I interviewed Dave Smith in 2014 while at Rockhurst University's Midwest Poet Series. You also heard him read today from The Wick of Memory, New and Selected Poems 1970 to 2000, and from Hunting Men, Reflections on a Life in American Poetry. In the other half of our conversation, he talks more about that book of essays and being a poet of place and reads from Hawks on Wires, poems 2005 to 2010. Links to these books from Louisiana State University Press and the previous program are at newletters.org. As we celebrate our radio show's 40th anniversary, we're highlighting our archives. Dave Smith is an example of how we followed careers that straddled two centuries. If you'd like to support us and enjoy earlier work by Dave Smith, look for a special package in our online shop with all his recordings and the New Letters magazine issue that contains his essay, When Bird Dogs Roam the Earth. Look under shop at newletters.org. Google links to our free weekly podcast or follow us on Facebook, Tumblr, and Twitter at New Letters Radio. A production of New Letters Magazine at UMKC, partial financial support comes from the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency. Thanks to Jamie Walsh, Elizabeth Albano, and Coy Duggar for production help. And to you for listening to New Letters on the Air. I'm Angela Elam.